Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Associate Professor Matabata Evodia Sitati, who is with the South African Grape and Wine Research Institute at the University of Stellenbosch and serves as co-director for the African Microbiome Institute, which is a coordinating and directive body for microbiome research, training, and service provision at Stellenbosch University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Amalia.
Sitati, you've pursued education with unwavering dedication from your roots in Limpopo to your PhD and beyond. And you've also traveled quite extensively from a work point of view. You've had posts in Limpopo, KwaZulu-Natal, the Free State, and Western Cape. Please tell us how your educational journey shaped your career.
Wow. So I'm from Limpopo province. I actually grew up in a township called Seshego. And I guess one could say I was lucky enough to be born into a family that is very education focused, in the sense that my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was a school teacher and a school principal and had all his children educated. I guess lucky for my father. When he met my mom, she was somebody who, I think she was the ninth child in her family, the last born of nine children. And she was somebody who was hungry for education, but unfortunately for her, her parents couldn't afford to, you know, to allow her to study further. And so she stopped school quite early in what at that time was called Standard 8, which is now grade 10. So when she met my father, she said to him, "Look here, I would like to further my education." So I was born into a household where at the, you know, at still in her 20s, in her mid-20s, my mother was furthering her education. So I grew up with this woman. So I'm the second born. I grew up with my brother. And when we were little, my mom was still studying for her primary teacher certificate. Then she went back to finish her matric and she did her primary teacher's diploma. And during apartheid, you know, a lot of Black teachers studied quite a lot because the payment system, you know, was such that every time they finished a certificate or a course, then there would be an increment in the salary. And so I grew up as the eldest daughter. So I have three younger sisters, but there's a huge gap between my brother and I, who are 2 years apart, and my three younger sisters, because they are 7 years, 9 years, and 11 years younger than me. So I grew up very close to my mother, watching her study all the time. And I kept wondering, but until when is this woman going to be studying? And so, you know, I think as a little girl, my intention and my goal with my education was just, if my mom is not stopping, I'm not stopping, because I have to do better than her. And that's what actually drove me quite a lot as a little girl to say, well, I don't know what this woman is studying, but, you know, where she stops, I have to be, you know, better than her. And yeah, and I think that's what drove quite a lot of my focus.
She sounds like an incredible role model. And also, you're highlighting this importance of socialization. When you're in this environment, and as a kid, she is your role model. You don't think of a world of being any different to what she's doing. And all of this influence that she had on you almost subconsciously.
Yeah. No, she did. It was quite a big influence. But my father was also, I think it might have been driven by fear for your children. So he was very strict. And so we had to be in school. My brother and I had to be in school. My younger sisters, when they came up, had to be in school. So he would give anything for us to not be on the streets. As you know, during apartheid, we had a lot of riots, a lot of toi-toi. It was quite easy for a young person to be drawn into, the challenges of the township and be involved in, the political battles and so on. And I think he was trying very much to shield us from that. But I mean, I went to the normal schools. All my primary education was in the township. I matriculated in the township, and I did my bachelor and my honors degree at University of Limpopo, which at that time was University of the North. I only came to Stellenbosch in 1996, so post our first democratic elections, to do my master's in microbiology. And at that time, again, I think things that drove me was because when I started at Stellenbosch, I was the only Black student in the lab, in our research lab. And I had this fear that if I failed, then all Black students following me would be judged based on my performance. So I worked very hard. And that became the beginning of my travels. You said I traveled quite a lot because then my supervisor sent me off to Sweden as an exchange student. And that's when I started, to travel all over, essentially. Yeah.
It reminds me of a Dr. Seuss quote, which is one of my favorite, and it goes words to the effect of the more you know, the more places you'll go.
True, true. Yeah.
You had a lot of pressure on your shoulders as you were going through, and not just on yourself, but just thinking about the other people that are coming up behind you. So in your role currently, your research delves into kind of like this invisible world of microorganisms in wine fermentation. Tell us what drew you to this niche intersection of microbiology, biotechnology, viticulture?
Yeah, wow. I have to say it's curiosity that drove me because when I finished matric, most young Black people at that time, you know very little about the different types of careers that are out there. And so when I finished matric, I wanted to be more on the medical side. So I remember my choices for university were MBCHB, so I wanted to be a doctor. That was like my first choice, or to do biomedical engineering, or to do chemical engineering. Microbiology was nowhere, on my radar. But when I finished matric, I went to University of Limpopo, which doesn't have medicine, and I did a BSc. And I majored in physiology and microbiology. I did a BSc because my entry requirement, I didn't meet exactly the entry requirements for medicine. And you could do a BSc and you could get the credits for those courses into medicine. And so that's what actually guided my choice in terms of the subjects. But then I fell in love with microbiology, and you couldn't pull me away from the microscope. It's just a fascinating world. I mean, you're working with things that you can't really see, but you can see all the different types of biochemical processes that they influence, because we would do practicals like making yogurt, making, doing different types of fermentations. And so you could see live what these invisible organisms could do. And that was just too interesting for me to pull away. And I remember, in Limpopo province, I think Botswana, Zimbabwe, and so on, there's a, the marula fruit. And in the villages, they make marula beer or marula wine, whichever term you choose to apply to it. We call it marula simply. And my dad and his friends and his brothers drank this beverage quite a lot. It's very short shelf life, so it's only made when the fruit are ripening at the beginning of the year, and then it's quickly off the market because it's just made by the women in the villages, and it's drank at that time and it's finished. And they used to say to me, you need to investigate what happens with this thing, because it would, I can't say this in a better way, but it would sometimes give them a running tummy. And they'll say, no, you need to investigate what is in this thing that is really, giving us this problem. And I could see that even just the ordinary people understand that there's something behind this, that, there has to be, so they could connect the microbiology to say there must be something in this that leads to this kind of reaction. And so you start to think like, okay, there's a lot of things that can be investigated. I can see them under the microscope. I can cultivate them. And yeah, and that just, it's really just curiosity driven. Everything that I have done was really just driven by the curiosity to understand what these organisms are doing. And I didn't start in wine fermentation. I've done research in different fields. I just ended up from 2010. I came back to Stellenbosch and came back to the Department of Viticulture and Oenology and the Institute now. But initially, I wasn't working on wine. I didn't do my master's on wine. I didn't do my PhD on wine. And my early research career was also not on wine.
The work that you do has got such a practical application, especially in consumables. Staying with this theme, you're co-director of the African Microbiome Institute. Can you tell us how your work contributes to understanding this interconnectedness of microbial communities across humans, animals, plants, and the environment? And thinking almost bigger picture, what are some of the implications on health as well as agriculture in the continent?
So I think, again, because these things are invisible, people don't think too much about microorganisms and their contribution. And I think that's why only now the world is catching up to microorganisms and their role. So essentially, if you think about it, there's nothing that doesn't have a microorganism on it. If you take swabs from your phone, from your keys, from, any surface, there are microorganisms. And so we are only now catching up to microbiome work.
I'm getting COVID flashbacks of. But please continue.
Microorganisms are everywhere. If you think about, so something as simple as salt production, so as an environment, which I started with when I started microbial ecology and looking at microbiomes in general, salt production, salt pans, crystallizer ponds from where the salt is made, there's tons and tons of microorganisms. People sometimes see this pinkish, reddish color in the crystallizer ponds. They don't realize that it's the microorganisms that are there that give this color. Soil has trillions of microorganisms in it. And so naturally, if you're planting crops in the soil, those crops interact with microorganisms in the soil. And in fact, we know that plants actually recruit microorganisms to their roots. So they select from whatever pool of microorganisms is that are in the soil, they select what would be beneficial to them. Some microorganisms help them to extract minerals from the soil. Some microorganisms protect them from dehydration and from drought. They absorb water and so on. And some of them protect them from potential pathogens. And so a plant as an organism has its own community of microorganism. And as humans, when we harvest the plant, when I always say to my student, a vineyard is an open system, right? So the grapes are exposed to whatever is in the air. If you disturb soil, the microorganisms are lifted from the soil and they land on the grapes. And so grapes are not sterile. No fruit is sterile. They come with microorganisms on them and sometimes in them, so inside the different tissues and so on. And so we eat these fruit, we eat vegetables, and they contribute to the microorganisms that are in our body, in our gut, some microorganisms are commensal on our skins, right? They are part of us. They live with us and they protect us from different types of infections. Some people don't realize that there are some vitamins that we cannot synthesize ourselves, like vitamin K is synthesized by the microorganisms in your gut. So sometimes we don't realize that we carry quite a significant amount of weight on our body is because of the microorganisms. When we eat fiber, it's the microorganisms that break down the polysaccharides that are in the fiber, right? So and so it stands to to for us, it's very clear that you harbor these different types of microorganisms. They have an impact on your health, because if they are helping you digest food, if they are synthesizing some essential compounds that you need for your health and for your blood to function properly and so on, then it's obvious that you can't. It's a full ecosystem that exists within us. We know in ruminous animals that the types of microorganisms that are there help them to digest all the grass, the fiber that they're consuming, and so on. So, in every organism, be it a plant, be it a human being, be it an animal, there's a whole community of microorganisms. What is important to us is, for instance, in agriculture, to understand the impact that we have as human beings. When we apply pesticides, when we apply fertilizers, how does that influence the microbial community composition dynamics in the soil, on the plants? How does it shift that? And obviously then how does that impact the ecosystem, right? Because some microorganisms are decomposers, some microorganisms are plant pathogens, some of them are plant growth promoting microorganisms. How does what we do as human beings influence this balance, and therefore how does that contribute to our health and well-being? Because then we start with soil health, which has an impact on crop health and animal health, and therefore an impact on human health in the end.
You live in a fascinating environment, and you've highlighted all of these complementary systems that we live with and we don't see. And one of the things that I think almost like the layman will consider is that when you're putting out a pesticide, it's killing everything, the bad, but the good too. And we kind of have this view of every bacteria is a pathogen, or every microorganism is a pathogen and going to cause harm. But actually, that's not the case at all, that we really need these entities within our systems.
No, that's true. I mean, it's there's a lot of chemical, let me put it this way, chemical fungicides, antimicrobials, pesticides, and we understand that it's sometimes necessary, right? Because as humans, we have demands, right? If tomorrow somebody says to you, well, we don't have tomatoes because we don't apply pesticides anymore, and all our crop was damaged I'm sure you will not be happy. So, farmers try to keep this balance of how can we make sure that the sufficient food to feed these billions of human beings on Earth, but at the same time try to manage what we use. I think there's a drive now and increasing interest in finding that balance. I think the agricultural revolution allowed for the mass production and not thinking too much about the environment. But I think now agriculture is looking back to say, how can we bring back that harmony between what exists in the environment as natural pests of different pathogens and different insect pests and so on, and have that balance, limit the amount of chemicals that we use, because they, in most cases, as you mentioned, they are broad spectrum, chemicals. So if it's a fungicide, it doesn't target one particular fungus. It's a broad spectrum fungicide. It kills everything. But can we find a balance? Can we reduce the amount of fungicides that we use? Can we have integrated systems in what we plant? We have plants that attract certain types of insects, or that harbor a different microbial community that will bring back the friendly microorganisms into the soil. I think agriculture is moving towards that way. We are really actively pursuing approaches where we can sort of start to bring in systems that encourage the establishment of, a balanced ecosystem in terms of the microbial community composition.
Wow, you're having an impact on people, on world, on planet, on sustainability. And thinking about the work that you do, thinking about how you almost fell into microbiology, perhaps saying this in the wrong way, but when we're young, we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what those opportunities are. And in your life, you've really had gone through all of these educational elements. You've had this transformation. How do you think we can support younger girls in under-resourced communities to be open to these types of opportunities in science?
You know what? I think exposure goes a long way. I interact with quite a lot of young people, and it's amazing how sometimes you would think that the limited exposure is perhaps in the rural areas, but even just being here in the Western Cape, just interacting with kids from the townships here, you realize how limited exposure they have to information. And you would think, well, everybody is walking around with some mobile device that they could just Google and so on. But if you don't know how to Google, you will not get the right information, for instance. And so I think just exposing young people to the different opportunities that are out there, to the emerging careers that are coming up, and just building confidence in young people. Today, I think our education systems are not building confidence. If we have a lot of people who have a general hesitance, for instance, for mathematics, we don't have that drive in us to say, no, it might be difficult, but you need it. And so you need to hang in there and find ways to make it easier. So I think exposure, last year and again this year in May, I will have a group of two schools from Guguletu and Belhar here in the Western Cape. I mean, last year we just showed them the type of research that we were doing. I introduced them to different careers in science, and they were just amazed. Something as simple, because in the wine sciences, then we have we go from viticulture, which is the cultivation of grapevines, all the way to sensory analysis. And just for them, for instance, realizing that there's actually a science in sensory analysis, they were flabbergasted, like, okay, so this is something which you study and you learn and you know. And so just exposing them to say, these are the opportunities that are opened and these are the different careers. Something like microbiology goes into everything, you know, in plant biotechnology, in pharmaceutical industries, in food and beverage industries, in biofuels production, in cosmetics, in so just making them aware of how wide and you know the net can be cast is enough to get them excited on things and not just say, well, microbiology is the study of organisms that you cannot see with the naked eye, but what can you do with those organisms and where do you find them and how do they impact your life? So I think it's just that exposure, and people don't realize that it's, kids don't know what these careers are about. You know, today we have data science as a huge growing career, but young people don't understand what is data science, for instance. So it's just exposing them to the careers, making them aware very early in their education what the requirements are. It's sad when you speak to young people. We had open day at our university like about 4 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. And to hear kids saying, no, I'm studying what is called maths literacy here in South Africa. And for you to look at somebody who is in grade 12 and say, but maths literacy, no university accepts maths literacy for anything. You understand? So that's very late. And so you need to be able to catch them early. You need to educate the educators about the importance of information and accurate information and not shying away from the difficult subjects just because we have to chase numbers. We have to say we have so much, you know, pass rate and so on. I think that's important.
But why are schools offering a redundant subject? Because if maths literacy is not going to take you anywhere, they are doing an injustice to young people who think that I'm doing maths, I'm doing X, but there is this qualifier against it of, or let's say a disqualifier against it when you're doing something like maths literacy.
Yeah, I think, look, we can't blame teachers per se, because it starts all the way from the education ministry, right? Because the teachers don't necessarily just out of the blue decide this is what the curriculum will be. They do get involved, I guess, in consultative processes and so on. But I think once that is decided upon, then it gets implemented. And obviously, naturally, people will choose the easy route. If you say, well, our measure is how many learners pass matric, they will choose what's going to make it easy for them to have the good numbers.
But it's so short-sighted. I'm just thinking about the throughput and thinking about everything that you're talking about, this whole ecosystem, the relationships between all these factors that we can't even see, but they exist. And here you have a very tangible value chain, but we're literally cutting it off at some point. And just because it's hard, we are putting a limit on kids' potential. Whereas if everybody worked a little harder in the system, that there wouldn't be a limit. So we're also quite passionate about education here. Prof. Sidharti, we're coming towards the latter part of the show. And one question that I ask all my guests is about some of the factors that they feel have contributed to their success. So sometimes people will talk about a particular person in their life or values or faith or discipline. In your opinion, what would you say have been some of your key drivers?
I guess for me, it has. I'm a hard worker naturally, from as far back as I can remember. I'm a hard worker, and I don't like to do anything substandard, and I think I always had this focus. I care very little about what the next person thinks. So if my intention is to achieve something, there's nothing you are going to say that's going to discourage me from pursuing that. And I think because I grew up under apartheid, I always had a thing at the back of my mind of somebody is looking at me and they think I can't do something. And as I said to you, when I came to Stellenbosch, because I was the only Black person, I literally had to say no. There's no way you will not get the pleasure of looking at a Black person and say, well, you see, we give them an opportunity and then this is what happens. So I think my journey has always been driven by that, because half of the time I'm the only Black person. I'm still the only Black person in my department, and my other colleague is colored in terms of South African terms. But yeah, so I'm still the only Black person, Black academic in my department. And so that, I guess, drive to succeed has always been there. At Free State, I was the only Black. I've pretty much spent my time being the only Black person that is focused on really showing young people that you can do it. If you have an interest in something, focus on what you can do, and do it, and care less about, you know, what the next person is saying. You know you can do it, so do it. And that has always been the drive for me, the discipline and the hunger to succeed. There was a time I was traveling with my PhD student, and we were in Austria, and we were staying in the same apartment. And every time we'd get to the apartment, I would take my laptop and start working. And then she would say to me, "My dear supervisor, is this what you do every night?" I said, "Well, you know, I don't have a choice. I have to work. For you to finish your PhD, I have to get the work done." And so it's that, the focus that one needs to have to understand that there's a lot of things that you will have to sacrifice in life. But if your goal is to succeed, everybody makes a sacrifice. I think sometimes we forget that everybody makes a sacrifice. Being a mother and looking after kids, it's a sacrifice. You know, you have to dedicate a certain amount of time to your children and forget a little bit for 2 seconds about yourself. Everybody makes some kind of sacrifice. And I think it's just understanding that the sacrifices will not be the same. They will not be equal, but some sacrifice will have to be made. And so for me, looking at my mother, looking at my aunts, so the women around me, they were hardworking women, and looking at them and saying, okay, this is what they achieved, but I can still see the struggles. And so it means for me to have what I consider to be a comfortable life, I will have to go so many levels higher for me to just have comfort. It's not to be, you know, rich. It's not to be a wealthy person, just to be comfortable. And in terms of my career, really, in that case, I'm very grateful for my parents. I never had to do anything to please my parents. So my choices were always for me. And so when things were not working, you know, in science, experiments don't work. When they didn't work, it wasn't that frustrating, because I always had to say to myself, Evodia, you chose this for yourself. Now get it done. While if you choose things for other people, it gets really frustrating and it weighs down on you. And you are most likely to quit because this wasn't really a choice for you. And so I think because everything that I have chosen to do in life was not my parents saying, we think you should follow this career, we think you should do this, we think you shouldn't work there, and so on. I have been able to keep myself focused and to say, well, this is what you wanted, you know, make it work. So, yeah.
You've really highlighted some of your personal ethos of hard work, of focus, of self-confidence, of discipline, of pursuing success, but also pursuing your own personal ambitions and not somebody else's in a very single-minded way. Lastly, as we close out today's show, please share a few words of wisdom that you'd like to pass on to girls and women that are listening to us.
Shoo. I think, you know, for young girls, I would say this, you know, we are all capable. Never underestimate your potential. Like, never. If you see something, if you are interested in something and you think, I would love to do that, do it. You know, don't doubt yourself. A lot of young people today doubt themselves a lot. They, if something fails the first time, they start thinking, maybe this is not for me, and so on. Every one of us go through that, but you have to have 2 seconds of self-doubt, and then you have to get up and say, no, I can do this. And so just trust in your own potential, focus on your dream. Don't let that ball roll to the left or to the right. Focus on it and chase after your dream. It's not weakness to ask for help. It's not weakness to ask for support, for guidance. Do that. If you feel that you need to have 5 people in your corner supporting you, find the 5 people, identify. And the 5 people you identify are not people who are going to say, yay. You know, I say to young people today, you come from the star generation, meaning that everything you got right, there was a star put on your forehead. And now you want everything you do, you want somebody to say, yay, well done. No, you have to say that to yourself. We were not given stars when I was in school. There were no awards for anything. I never received an award my entire education life. Like, so validate yourself. Don't wait for the other person to come and say, well done. You set yourself to do something. Once you've done it, you set yourself, well done. I got it done and I'm happy with what I have. If you're not happy, reflect on it and say, okay, what could I do differently next time? But do not underestimate yourself. Do not shoot yourself down. I think that would be my advice.
Thank you so much for joining us, for opening up the world of microbiology to us, but also sharing the insights into yourself in terms of what have been some of your drivers that everybody can take away. It's been a pleasure to host you. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and that was Associate Professor Matabata Avodia Satati, who is with the South African Grape and Wine Research Institute and also serves as co-director of the African Microbiome Institute at Stellenbosch University.